Hi, Amanda.
Oh, hi, Enid. Sorry, give me one sec. I'm here.
No worries. I was going to give you a second.
There you are. Hey. Hi. Love the podcast situation.
Yes. Thank you. So yeah.
Thank you for all of your patience, first and foremost. Very, very grateful.
Pandemic life is crazy. Mom life is crazy.
Crazy.
Mom life is next.
How old are your children?
9, 7, and 5.
9, 7, and 5. Got it. Wow. So I have a 9 and a 6-year-old. So we're in the same boat. Yeah. It's a lot. Although I don't have 3. So
yeah, it doesn't matter. After 2, it's kind of like you're outnumbered anyways. Yeah. It's all relative. Well, I'm so excited to hear about your new book. It's really like a really cool story, a really like tied into like the fabric of Montauk. Tell me a little bit more about, well, first of all, welcome to Hamptons Consciousness.
Thank you so much.
Where we try to uncover kind of like the real Hamptons and, you know, we see past the like, you know, manicured hedges and try to speak to people and kind of unveil what real people are doing. What really goes down other, you know, once everybody leaves for Labor Day. So we have been talking to a lot of like environmentalists, like authors, writers, psychics, just basically everyone and anyone that comprises, you know, what we love and what we know of as the East End. So tell us a little bit more about you and then we'll dive right into the book, which I can't wait to hear.
Yes, yes, of course. So I am originally from, I grew up in a suburb of Los Angeles, and I moved to the East Coast for college and just sort of essentially never moved back to California, which I think a lot of people still find puzzling. Although we did 2 years in Northern California, but that's an aside. So we have been in Sag Harbor off and on since about 2009. And I was actually working I worked a big jobs in the city. Once we started having children, I realized I didn't want to work 80 hours a week and have 2 nannies raising our children and never be home. So as many moms, I was looking for a type of work that would be lend itself to more flexibility. And that was when we sort of gave it a year-long experiment to see what it would be like living here year round. And 1 year turned into the rest of the years, and we grew to love it. We eventually left the city, had another child, and it was while working actually as a staff reporter at the East Hampton Star in the winter of 2016, which was actually just before I left to go full-time freelance, that this story was shared with me as a potential magazine assignment, which of course morphed into my first book, which is called The Lost Boys of Montauk. It came out just before Memorial Day weekend, and it's just been such a whirlwind. It's now in its 6th printing. These are micro printings. So this is not like I've sold millions of books or anything close to that, but you know, it's been very exciting. I did over 40 events this summer and into the fall, a lot of in-person events. Obviously now more of it is virtual.
Yeah. Given the state of our— Yes, too.
Yes, I did a CBS segment, which was so cool and sort of opened it up to a much more national audience, because many of the themes in the book, obviously, it is much hyper-local, and it obviously really resonates with people that are familiar with the East End, but there's certainly many, many of the themes around grief and loss that are very, very universal. The lack of closure in the story, many folks can relate to as well. So it's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us a little bit more about the Windblown. I feel like I grew up on Long Island and I grew up summering in East. So I remember when that happened, like I was little, like I'm a child of the 80s. So like, what was that, like 84?
This was 84. I'm also a child of the 80s. I was born in 1980. And so at the time, a new editor, he's mentioned in the book, Biddle Duke, who is now a friend and colleague, of course, was starting a new magazine, and we were brainstorming story ideas. And he started talking about this great untold story of this area. And he said, you know, there was a storm, and I think it was 1984. And actually, in that first conversation, he couldn't exactly recall the name of the boat. Was it the Windswept? It was the Wind something. And, but most importantly, he started speaking in a lot of detail about these 4 young men who lost their lives at sea. And it was this sort of unforecasted hurricane, and about 12 miles, actually, so not very far from Montauk Point, was their sort of last radio contact. And everyone else from the fleet had sort of just made it in the night before. This was March 29th, 1984, that they were due back, and they just disappeared. and the men were never recovered. You know, pieces of the boat were found and sort of started showing up on different beaches and bays. But the, you know, the boat itself, the hull of the boat and what have you, was never salvaged from the bottom of the ocean. And, you know, what was so interesting about it was that when I started the project, it really started with Mary Stedman, who was the widow and the, you know, the kind of main living protagonist of the story. She's the widow of the captain, and she was all of 29 when she lost her 32-year-old husband, and she was already the mother of three boys living in East Hampton. So obviously, when I started out, I knew that this was a story of the four men and their histories, and there's a very interesting class component in it of this sort of upstairs-downstairs dynamic, which I find endlessly fascinating to this day. You know, the relationship between the summer people and the, you know, the working class, and yep, how they do and don't interact with one another.
And how they definitely did in that case, right?
Yes, they all, these four men from very disparate backgrounds, certainly found themselves on the same boat, which was part of the origin of why I found the story so fascinating. But I took a reporting trip out to Montauk in the fall of 2017, just as I was getting ready to sell the book. And, you know, I knew at the time, obviously, this was very, very personal to the people who knew and loved these men, their friends, their family, et cetera. But it was out at the lighthouse that I had this very chilling interaction with, you know, I ran into just as the gates were closing, and I had brought a friend along, and we kind of just narrowly, you know, got in before it closed. And the lighthouse keeper was there, it turns out, and, you know, this gentleman from the Montauk Historical Society. And I said, oh, I'm here researching the Windblown, thinking they would have no idea what the heck I was talking about. And, you know, Marge Winsky, the former lightkeeper, said, oh, you mean March 29th, 1984. And I said, wow. Why, yes, indeed. And she said, oh, well, I was working at a bank downtown as a teller, and I'll never forget that day, of course. And then one of the other men had gone to college with Captain Stedman and knew him personally. And of course, he, you know, would send me these photographs from back, you know, from that era in the subsequent months and years to follow. And so it just became a way that I saw, obviously, I didn't grow up here, so I couldn't appreciate it, but it was this kind of hyper-local tragedy where, say, like you had grown up in Hampton Bays or West Hampton Beach or farther up island, you would have heard of the storm. Maybe you kind of peripherally knew that someone had died at sea, but it certainly wouldn't have hit you nearly as hard as it would have the year-round community that was obviously much smaller then and significantly more close-knit than it is now. So that's when I just found it even more fascinating, how it is that these kind of hyper-local events really kind of changed fundamentally who we are in our relationship to a place.
And that so many of those families are still are local.
Oh yes, of course. Right. These are families with deep roots to the East End and Long Island in particular. Yeah.
Was it Stedman's widow? Didn't she pass like a year or two ago? I feel like some.
Not Mary. Mary's well alive and well. She's in her mid to late 60s, but Alice Connick, Dave and Pete's mother passed away from Parkinson's the fall before the book came out, unfortunately. Yeah. I'm so grateful to be able to interview her.
And then tell us about like the actual vessel. Like, wasn't there like problem like with the actual boat? Like it wasn't necessarily seaworthy. Like that was part of like the folklore. Was that true?
Yes. The boat itself was kind of this fascinating mystery that I got to kind of unpack. So, you know, Mike Stedman had grown up learning how to become a party boat fisherman. And then he kind of started, you know, going into more of the commercial fishing realm and going out for tilefish, which were hugely plentiful and lucrative during sort of the mid-70s to the mid-80s. And then after, you know, working for someone else and having a boss that wasn't himself, he decided, you know, now's the time finally to kind of strike out on my own and get my own boat and sort of be my own boss and provide for my family, of course. And so, you know, for whatever reason, he really zeroed in on this particular boat that was down in Galveston, Texas, of all places. You know, we live on an island that's surrounded by water
and boats.
Many boats up and down the East Coast, right? But for whatever reason, this boat really spoke to him. Obviously, if he were still alive, I would love to find out more about why this particular boat was the case, right?
Right.
So it actually had been a boat that originated in Captree, Long Island, and was a party boat. And then some modifications were made to it. I guess anytime, well, now I know, anytime you sort of take a vessel and then make changes to the size of it and the length of it or the width of it, it, you know, it changes the nautical structure of it and the engineering of it. So that happened. It went down to Texas and it was just a boat used to kind of ferry workers around the oil rigs. And then when Mike brought it back up from Texas all the way up to Montauk with his buddies, they needed it to be used as a longliner to go tile fishing, to put out these miles and miles of line that would sink to the bottom to catch these fish. And so there wasn't really a lot of room. It was a 65-foot boat. And so they cemented on top of the boat, on top of the wooden wheelhouse, this drum that would release these miles and miles of fishing line. So the boat was steel, you know, the base of the boat was steel, which was great. The wooden pilot house really wasn't great, given its durability.
Made it, like, super top heavy.
And then the drum added on top of it just made it very, very top heavy. And, you know, I actually had a conversation with Chris, who is the captain's eldest son, who you get to know in a lot of detail in the last chapter of the book and throughout. And it's interesting. Obviously, we'll never know the answer to many of the things in this story. But his assessment was that his father, there's some family secrets that are revealed throughout the book, especially toward the end of the book. And, you know, his sort of personal assessment, I don't want to give the book away. Hopefully some of your listeners haven't read it, but that he felt like his father sort of subconsciously felt as though his life was a bit out of control, particularly his marriage and his personal life. And so he wasn't necessarily making the most clear-eyed decisions that maybe someone in a different place in their life would make. Obviously, he was an experienced seaman, and it's not as though he didn't know, you know, how to make good decisions and good financial decisions for his family, but that maybe there was something else kind of underlying the particular decision of this boat, obviously, given that there were just so many other boats and choices to be made in very close proximity to where he was living in East Hampton at the time. So it's just something to think about, another layer that we'll never really know the answer to, given that his father passed away so many years ago.
I think that kind of like makes the magic of the book, you know, like you still have so many questions, even though you're like telling us a story.
Exactly.
You know, it's like opening up your mind to like, all of the, like, you know, your brain just travels in all these other directions. Like, what if this had happened? Or what if this, and then the storm itself was so like mysterious.
So mysterious. And you think back in, you know, the early to mid 80s, the weather, I mean, still the weather forecasting isn't great on the eastern end of Long Island, right? We're getting a snowstorm. We're not getting a snowstorm. And way back then, you know, they didn't even really have much offshore weather forecasting. They'd get a report twice a day. These guys had been out for a week. I mean, it was just very, very hard to predict. And this truly was an unforecasted hurricane that would just whip its way up the East Coast. And, you know, it caused a ton of damage, not just on Long Island, but in Connecticut and in Boston. It eventually actually toppled the lighthouse on Nantucket. Like, it was just that ferocious of a storm. And they were in a particularly treacherous spot of the Atlantic, where it's kind of shallow and there are all these shoals, and you know, you can imagine 30, 40 foot waves coming at you, 100-mile-an-hour winds. And this was not a gigantic, you know, ocean liner that they were on. This was a 65 foot fishing boat that had some structural issues. So, just the timing of it all and being certainly in the wrong place at the wrong time. And another part of that decision-making, not just the boat, but was, you know, why did he stay out longer than anyone in the fleet? Were they just catching so many fish? You know, why had all of his peers come in so much sooner? Why did he stay out as long as he did? And we'll never know the answer to that.
Right. Like, could they have maybe have been in distress like earlier? Or
exactly.
Who knows?
Who knows? Yeah, there was never a mayday call. Some of the other boats, you know, called the Coast Guard for help that were caught in those same conditions, maybe 12 hours prior. But yeah, why it was that he stayed out as long as he did is another mystery of the story that unfortunately we'll never know.
It's fascinating. I feel like, you know, a lot of people like know about the East End, but like, I don't think that people really know how like unique Montauk is, like in relation to the rest of the Hamptons.
Right. I think that's so true. I mean, I still would say that there is a wilder aspect to Montauk than, say, you know, certainly Southampton, East Hampton. And I feel like as you get going along, you know, so maybe the Amagansett Dunes and then certainly the Nepigue stretch and then out to Montauk, it really kind of shifts. Also topographically, it changes. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I think another part that I loved about researching this book was just that I wish I had been able to be living here during that era of the late 70s and early 80s. And this is, of course, before the crazy Wall Street money poured in.
Yeah.
And
when it was like all the writers and like everyone was like being inspired, and it was
a very creative period. A lot of painters and writers and poets, and certainly in Sag Harbor where I live, especially, and in Springs and what have you. And yeah, this is way before anyone had thought to, you know, tear down a really cool cottage and build a McMansion, and you know, all of those things were yet to occur. So it was a much simpler time. And I think in many ways, I long for that as well. You know, I can certainly empathize with people that have lived here for generations and have seen these different changes.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Like people in their like 70s are probably like, what has happened? Like
what's happened
in their lifetime? Yeah. Like they've seen just so much change.
So much like, change. Yeah. And the idea of a son or a daughter, right, not being able to buy a house in the towns in which they had grown up in, that a middle class person just could not afford to maybe, you know, buy a home here. We're seeing that with our children go to Sag Harbor Elementary School, and you know, much of, as with many of the schools here, the teachers all have to do these insane commutes because no one can afford to live here, you know, predominantly, unless maybe they have a family home or a spouse that's making significantly more income. But it's a real challenge here of how, you know, that there's a very, very sizable population that needs to work here.
Yeah.
And where do they commute from?
Yeah. That's like a really fascinating topic that's obviously not correlated to the book, but correlated to the East End for sure. So I guess tell me more about like what drew you to the East End. Is your husband from the area? Like why the East End? And then why do you love it so much?
So my husband is also not from the East End. My husband emigrated from India actually when he was 5 or 6 years old. And his family is now in California as well. He's an academic. He teaches at Columbia. We started coming out here when we were dating, and I had spent some time here in my early 20s, and I sort of introduced him to the area. We actually started by going out to Montauk. I think we both just felt eventually like we had done the city thing, and we had done all the things we wanted to do. Not that we both don't love still going there and getting that fix and seeing our friends and you know, getting an amazing meal and seeing a show again before the pandemic, although I've been recently going back more. Yeah, I think we just decided we wanted a different lifestyle, especially once we started having children, and both of us love being outside. I've started doing, last winter, I wrote a piece about it in the Times. I've started doing these cold water plunges once a week that I do all throughout the winter. Yep. And that's been really kind of a neat way. I love the ocean in general. I do a lot of walking. I do a lot of swimming and learned how to surf this summer. And so it's just been fun to incorporate the water into the rest of the year, which I kind of just never would go in otherwise. I love the light. I really actually love the seasonality. You know, I think a lot of, as long as I can try and get away a little bit sort of from now until March for a little bit of sunshine.
February, March get a little testy, but I feel like I love December because of the holidays. And then like January, you know, was kind of hit or miss. By February, I'm like, all right, Caribbean.
Time to get some sun. Yeah, exactly. But you know, if it were as crazy as it were from say July and August, the rest of the year, I would have no interest in living here. And this particular August, I mean, we live just a little bit from downtown, and I would do anything I could to avoid having to go downtown. It was just really, it was the busiest I've ever seen. September is really my favorite. September and October, I love. The water's still warm. There's no one here.
That's the best.
Obviously, the population certainly changed just after COVID. I feel as though some people decided to stay out, you know, this next year, but fewer than the year before. And now it's, certainly in Sag Harbor, I feel like the lights are on, you know, there are people living here. Whereas when we were in the Northwest Woods in East Hampton, we were kind of the only game in town for a while. A friend of mine describes it as the July people and the August people. And the August people are the people who paid so much money to rent their house. They are just like, you know, if every day is not the most perfect beach day and, you know, they can't get a parking spot downtown, they're just in kind of a terrible mood. Obviously, I'm speaking in huge generalities, but,
no, but
there's definitely something to that. I think I was hoping this last summer, you know, that the pandemic, there might be a more feeling of universality, or we've all just gone through something and maybe it's a time to be a little kinder and more generous with one another. But that was certainly not my personal experience. One of the things I loved about researching this book and also having worked at the Star is that the Star style, the newspaper style, forbids the use of the Hamptons. If you want to use the Hamptons, it has to be used in quotes. And the Hamptons was actually an advertising slogan that real estate agents came up with to try and lure city people to come out and buy a home on the East End. And so the Star actually requires that you use the town exactly as you're saying.
You know,
is it Montauk? Is it East Hampton? Is it Wainscott? Is it Southampton? Rather than review, or North and South Fork.
It's just this
gigantic, you know, mass of all of these different communities and places. So I think that's so interesting to think about too, how commercialized it's been and spun off into these different TV shows and in the ways in which we think
exactly
about it.
Like I just saw this like horrifying one, like selling the Hamptons.
I saw that. I haven't seen it, but I saw it as well. And I did definitely a little bit of an eye roll there.
Yeah. Like that, like there's one thing that we don't need any of. It's a TV show, like bringing more people to the Hamptons. That's number one. But number two, more real estate agents. Like it's almost like a meme at this point. Like there is nobody that I don't like. There are more real estate agents, I think, than people out East.
And it's really true.
It's like a real,
I mean, it is very lucrative, obviously, if you can sell a few $10 million houses.
Yeah. You really just need to sell like a couple of homes. Like if you're in the right
bracket,
you're fine.
I always joke to my friends. I mean, obviously I'm a writer and I'm a print writer at that. So I'm not cashing my $10 million checks, but I always joke that if they see me becoming a licensed real estate person to do some type of an intervention, it means that I've sort of lost my way. Like I could do a lot of other things happily, but I just feel like the real estate thing is locked down and there are many capable people doing it. So I'm not going to go down that path for the time being.
That whole thing is insane.
It is insane and extremely cutthroat. I mean, just in terms of
like getting the listings,
the clients and the listings and the I could, I personally just don't have the metabolism for it as a human. It would really stress me out.
Agreed. What do you want people to know about your book? What do you want people to know about the East End? Just open forum.
So the book kind of toggles around in time from, you know, sort of the 1950s until present. I introduce myself in the book as a character, not as an exercise in narcissism. And in a lot of my work, I remove myself and it's obviously only about the subjects, but you know, this is a very insider culture. You know, I'm very much of an outsider and I tried to view it with as much empathy, of course, for everyone that I interviewed. I interviewed over 100 people over a 2.5 year period of time, but also just knowing that I really tried to do my best and make it really objective. So I certainly have, you know, the feedback has been, you know, pretty universally positive. However, of course, not everyone is going to like every book. And in particular with this book, it's just been interesting to get the feedback of many of, say, the local residents or those who knew and loved these men. I think a lot of people have felt, certainly the feedback I've gotten at a few of the events I did over the summer was that, you know, there was this idea that the book should have been written by an insider. And how dare I kind of stray from the script? And why didn't I just keep it about the men and the boat and the fishing and the storm? And why did I delve into maybe the more sort of psychological side of these women and the trauma and the lasting effects? And what business did I have sort of doing that? And to be honest, you know, I think all along, I was never interested in rewriting a different version of The Perfect Storm, right? Sebastian Younger wrote that book and it's a great book. And if that's the book you want to read,
then
read it and love it because it's amazing. It's an amazing book. But I think a lot of people, when they see a sea story, you know, that's not written by an old white man, they want it to just be that kind of similar narrative.
That same narrative. Exactly.
Yeah. And so this is definitely not that. I get lots and lots of people with different story ideas about, you know, shipwrecks from the 18th century for my next project. I'm not going to do another sea story.
Right. You're like, this is not my new genre. This is my niche.
I'm not going to write The Lost Daughters of Amagansett next. you know, I'm actually not going to write another East End story next as a book project. I'm going to you know, move on to another. Maybe I'm not saying I won't revisit this area again.
Movie project.
Yes. So I did actually, very excitingly, I had a lot of producer interest this summer, and we finally narrowed it down to a wonderful producer called Bert Salke, who has a deal at Disney and ABC, which is now owned by the same company, because everything's now owned by the same company. And we're actually working right now to attach a showrunner to it for a limited series.
So cool.
So we'll see. I mean, again, it's you know, it's a 10% chance, I guess, that it would get made. But things are looking good. And this guy has a very amazing track record of getting quality things made.
Wow.
It's just interesting seeing it play out in obviously a different medium. There's not a sentence in my book that's not true. So in this, you can base it on, you know, the true story, the book, which is the intellectual property, but then you can add in, you know, fictional layers of detail that bring these characters obviously to life in the way that I could never do since I'm not writing fiction.
That's really cool. That's super.
But yeah. I hope people sort of see this, you know, it was also an obsession I got. I did a very deep dive. I don't know if it was because it was my first book.
Unintended.
Yeah. I was throwing paint at a wall and I didn't know how the heck I was going to put it all together. And I needed to learn about so many things that I knew nothing about. I'm not exactly a commercial fisherman at all, full stop. I'm not a surfer. You know, I don't know so many parts about the history of the East End that I was able to learn about. And I didn't become an expert on grief and trauma, but I certainly know a whole lot more about it than I did when I started this project. So yeah.
I feel like that humanizes the story though.
It does. Okay. Yeah.
You know, if you want to read a shipwreck story, there's plenty to choose from. But I feel like that aspect of it hasn't necessarily been covered, or I haven't really read it covered before your book.
Obviously, I don't know if a man were to have written this book. The men came most alive to me when I interviewed their mothers and their girlfriends. And
of course,
the women part was like just the most fascinating part to me. Right. Exactly. And Chris, the son as well, of course, the surviving son, the women were obviously the most, not obviously for me, obviously the most compelling part of it. Mary, endlessly fascinating. I'll never stop thinking about her and her many different layers, but also just the way in which so many people in the story never moved on from this. It's not as though there's this great kind of happy silver lining. You know, life is difficult, and this book is very, very sad. Yeah. I feel like it ends in a slightly
like hopeful. It just had no closure. It's not like
the
body
exactly.
were recovered, like you can't bury anyone, you know? So like there was just so many question marks still then and now.
Exactly. I tried to end the book.
Which is obviously
slightly
traumatic.
Uplifting note. It is traumatic. It is traumatic. It is traumatic. One final thought. In addition to Mary and certainly the men, I obviously would have loved nothing more than to have interviewed the four men lost at sea. But Scott Clark, who is the fourth crew member about whom I went into the book thinking, oh, I'm going to get to know these four men in equal detail, right? Obviously, I'm going to research this book. I'll know them all. Scott was, I still feel like I just have the silhouette of who he was because he was very new to the area and he had a single mom who had already passed away and his dad, you know, abandoned him when he was very, very young. So I only ever got to really know him through a first cousin and a distant uncle.
So not even anybody that like hung out with him every day or
no,
grew up with him.
No. And I probably tried 25 people this girl that he had been dating. I could never track her down. And I sort of specialize in tracking people down. I'm like, who was this guy? But one story about his mom, and then I'll stop talking, is just that. So his mom, Donna, worked for TWA Airlines. And when the boat went down, she was convinced, as some people were, that they had landed, say, in Bermuda, and they had hit their heads and they had suffered amnesia. And her son was out there in the world, but he just didn't remember anything. So she spent literally the rest of her life, and probably lost her marbles a bit near the end, taking her TWA miles and flying to the Caribbean and South America. And then she'd get in her car and drive around the country and put up missing posters for her son. Literally believing that she might find him. And, you know, as a mother, how do you get over that? How do you get over the loss of your child? I mean, just the loss of your child is a trauma. He went out to sea and he was never found again. How does the human mind process that? You know, so much of our grief process is around there being an endpoint. and a clear, okay, I'm at a funeral. There's a body in the casket, and this is terribly sad and will affect me for the rest of my life. But at least I know that there's a conclusion here. And so Donna's story was, you know, just so haunting and chilling. And I feel for her. I really, really do. I just can't imagine.
Oh my gosh, that's so like romantic and like so sad at the same time.
So sad. Yeah. But, like, she would go on like her, she would use her vacation time and her models and
but like just like a testament of like how strong like a mother's love is, you know? It's like she never stopped searching. It's heartbreaking.
She never stopped. She went to her grave believing somewhere he was out there and she just hadn't been able to find him. Well, anything else that you'd like to talk about that I
So where can we find your book? Obviously, I'm sure we can find it online, but tell us all the local, like out East retailers, and tell us if you have any speaking engagements or anything that we need to look out for.
Obviously, you can buy the book online at different online retailers whose names everyone can figure out and probably know as well. But if you do happen to be out East, our two local bookstores, which are actually two locations. So Southampton Sag Harbor Books has a bunch of signed copies, as does Bookhampton and East Hampton. They've been tremendously supportive. I just really can't thank them enough in terms of getting the word out and, you know, making the book the success that it was and it is. And then a paperback version is actually coming out on May 17th. So that's something to look forward to as well. And I'm still figuring out, you know, what my publicity schedule is going to be around that in the kind of late spring, early summer. But I'm starting a new project and I can't do 40 more book events. So I'm going to try and rein it in a little bit, while also helping to get the word out about the paperback, of course.
Great. Yeah. Well, yeah, definitely let me know. And I'll let like the Hamptons Moms community know.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah. I would really appreciate that.
Chatting. Everybody get The Lost Boys of Montauk, whether out East or online. And it was so nice talking to you.
Thank you. It was so nice talking to you. I appreciate your interest and your time. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. Bye. Take care. Bye.